You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to Guys Who Like Musicals.
Welcome to Guys Who Like Musicals.
Dan?
Joe?
This is kind of a wild week. I'm a little freaked out about our guest because our guest is basically, I've dubbed, I don't know if you like this, but I'm calling him the Ron Howard of musical theater.
Wow.
Do you like that? I don't know. It's new. We could cut
How
it.
Could you not like that?
Michael Arden is here.
Hey, what a way to be introduced, my God. I mean, I'll take it. I'm a big fan of Ron Howard. So
this is crazy. Well, I think that our first question, which is again it's not a good question, but Dan and I were talking this morning. How do we become you?
How do you do it? What's the secret?
What's the secret sauce? I mean, actor, what do you eat? Writer, director, musician, lyricist, I mean, like TV, film, theater, musical theater, you've done all of these things. So how do we do
that? I wouldn't
say
it's necessarily fun.
Yeah, but I hate it.
Yeah, no, I don't hate it at all. I don't know. I mean, I'm very flattered, but I don't think anyone would actually want to be me because, you know, like with everybody, it's like we see that. We see the bit you see, and then the rest is like, you know, you never really know what's going on in people's like lives. And, you know, most days I'm, you know, I want to be somebody else. So I think, you know, that like fallacy is like, I want to make sure people listening know that like, I'm not like living in some, you know, amazing world where everything's perfect. But I am very lucky to have worked in like lots of different fields in entertainment. And I don't know how it really happened. I think it's with everything in this business, it's like hugely to do with being in the right place at the right time and luck and somebody, taking a risk and a chance on me. But also just, at a certain point, like, you know, a lot of people don't like to necessarily give opportunities. They like to sort of feel like they have discovered something already in process. So I think just like so many times I've just like raised money on Kickstarter and like done it myself because I'm like, well, nobody will like take a meet. When I was first trying to be a director, I was like, nobody would even consider me as a director, or think about it or even, you know, entertain the idea. So I was like, you know what, I'm going to assist some directors on my own. And then I'm going to raise money on Kickstarter and direct my own plays, and the right people came to see them and they're like, you're really good. And then it was just like, oh, I've always been a director. Of course he's a director. As opposed, you know, it's like, sometimes you just got to bake the cake before somebody says they want cake.
Oh, that's great. That's really great. Write it down.
This is off to a great start. I am thrilled.
Mixing my metaphors, so it's good.
So an actor is saying his lines, and then out of nowhere, he just starts singing. 5, 6, 7, 8.
Jimmy, don't cry for me.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
It's inspiring to hear that from somebody who we only see your arrival. Right. We don't see all of the things you had to do to get to where you are, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Nobody sees like what a nightmare, like, you know, backstage looks. You don't see, you know, you see what, you know, optics are everything. And I feel that it's important to know that, like you said, the arrival is based upon an incredibly nonlinear journey. You know, it's like there's that great animation of like what people think that like somebody's path is, which is a straight line to somewhere, but it's actually this like insane squiggle that almost never goes directly toward the destination.
The Christmas Carol is just remarkable. This movie, if anybody hasn't seen it yet,
this version of it was just for this Christmas and just to help regional and community theaters around the U.S. Have some income when they can't invite people into their auditoriums. So I hope everybody watches it. It was a really wild and special thing, and it came together so quickly. I mean, we didn't know we were doing it until like September, and then like it was done on election day. It was a wild ride.
It was fantastic. I had a great time watching it, watching Jefferson, watching your work. I could see pieces of, you know, some of the things I've noticed in some of your shows there, but the way that you guys utilized camera to make the story clear, even though there was only one actor, and the way that all of the production elements came together. I'm sure it was based off of the version that you did at the Geffen?
Yeah. So
originally?
Yeah. Two Christmases ago, we did this production at the Geffen, and that was the first time we'd ever done it. And I would say it's like 95% the same as what it was at the Geffen, almost completely. There's like a couple of new things. And we had to slightly adjust. The theater that we did the filming in did not have traps. So anything coming out of the floor had to be rethought. So we had to kind of like rethink just how things happen. But that's pretty much what it was. So it was fun getting to, I love getting to revisit something because it like, it just is like the best gift. And to get to do it, especially when we did it at the United Palace this Christmas, I mean, the crew we had on the show, because all of the Broadway shows were shut down, was like the most insane like group of people I have ever been around. I mean, it was like the head carpenter from like every incredible show was like, you know, our like deck crew, and the best props person. We had our pick of, it was insane. It was like the most amazing tech I've ever had. And I was kind of like, I had to remind myself this will never happen this way again, because you know, not that everyone isn't great, but it was like the Olympics of stage crew. So I just have to here and now say like our production team on putting this together. I mean, we teched and shot it in like 2 weeks. You know, it was nuts.
And how did you do it from a production standpoint? This is obviously where my brain's going to go, Joe. Did you do piece to piece?
No, we teched the, and so part of the endeavor was to basically assemble and tech the show for next year, hopefully. So we teched the whole play like it was a Broadway show. I mean, just like beginning to end, the cameras weren't there. Our DP was with me from the beginning, Maceo Bishop, who's amazing. And he like sat in rehearsal and we talked about what we wanted camera to do. And he sort of thought about that. But we really just focused on like creating the piece of theater first, because it was really important that this not be like NBC Live kind of made built for the camera. Like this is what you see in the show is like really, when you come to see the show, hopefully, knock on wood, next year, like that is what it looks like. Almost like that's what it is. It's like, that's the show. Right. There aren't any special things we did for camera. So we tech the play, and then it's a real lesson in darkness in the theatrical experience. Yeah. So like really there are like moments of like complete and utter darkness where we had to like put like blankets over our computer monitors so that we could make sure that we were like, we couldn't see like anything, because it was really right. important for when you come to see the show that there are moments that you're like truly afraid of what's going to happen next. So we right. went through that process, and then we had spent one day. So we teched the whole show, and we did like a dress rehearsal stumble through in which like we showed the camera operators what it looked like. And then we spent a day sort of relighting the show just for balances for camera, because obviously picking right. up different things and adding some backlight here and there to sort of separate Jefferson right. from the background. But that was just one day. And then we filmed the next day, we filmed two performances, one starting at 9 a.m. and one in the afternoon. And that's what you see. So it's literally just, wow. we ran it twice all the way through, sort of without stopping. And then assembled that, and you know, Jefferson's so incredibly, what's the word I'm looking for?
Consistent.
He's able to consistent. Yeah. He's so consistent that like, you really could like, you know, if we needed to, like, if there was a weird sound bump or something, you could like take a sentence and it just, and it would literally fit in his mouth from the prior performance wow. that day. He's just, wow. such an amazing performer that like, I think with any lesser actor, we couldn't have done what we did in so short a time. So yeah, that's two performances, one day, what you saw. So that was sort of how we did. And wow. the cameras came in and they got in the positions. And then for the second show, they sort of moved positions a little bit. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's how we did it.
Yeah. The continuity difficulty that you would have, what I mean is putting one performance into another performance is impossible unless the actor's physical placement is almost exactly the same. And in stage, we're not necessarily taught to like have a perfectly consistent physical presence. But I assume yeah. with Jefferson, you were able to almost map them show for show.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not ever something we discussed, right. like the consistency. I think there was like... you know, in addition to this, there's a whole other side of this, which after we filmed what you saw this Christmas, we spent 5 days shooting a proper movie, which no one has even seen yet, which will hopefully come out on, you know, Netflix next year. But so that was like a different process. But
is that,
so
that on the stage?
That required more continuity. It's like on the stage, it's in the audience. It's like under the theater. Cool. It's above the theater.
Cool.
It's also on location as well. It's kind of a... more soon on that. That's kind of an exciting
real news, narrative. Joe. This is a real news podcast. Yeah, you got to hear first.
But the show is sort of devised in a way that like it becomes really dangerous if he's like not in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. true, like Michael Arden, Dane Laffrey fashion, who's my designer, like. We call it zero tolerance because like you have to be like exactly here, one for lighting and two, cause there's like turntables and moving walls and flying pieces and it's all in the dark. And if you're like not on your mark, like look out, you know, there's a lot of infrared cameras at work to make sure that he's safe. But, and I have to hand it to him. I've only stepped on the stage while it's in motion a couple times and it's absolutely terrifying. Like I you know, you're like, it's a black stage, he's wearing black clothing, like the floor is turning, the walls are moving, fire, there's stuff coming out of the ceiling, like it's like a Indiana Jones trying to get into the you know, the temple of doom
yeah. right? That's wild.
Oh my gosh. Well, I hope we get to see it next Christmas live in theaters. And it was so cool. And it was really emotional to watch, as you know, as actors, not, you know, sitting at home thinking about this experience in the middle of a pandemic. How I'm glad to hear it was kind of as amazing as it was with that crew and everybody. Was everybody must have just been so happy to be at work.
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody was so happy to be working after having so much time off. And, you know, during COVID, it was like, we're all wearing face masks and spaced out and can't, you know, theaters, you know how it goes. You're like always got your arm around mm-hmm. each other, you know? So this was certainly different, but it was, you know, it was also thrilling. We did recognize again, like I said, the fact that like we were working with the top people in each department and So. We had shorter days because of we were on a SAG contract and we could only work so many hours a day, which were like so many hours less than what we're used to doing in the theater. Like we never had a 10 out of 12 and we teched the show in shorter because we, you know, every day we're like, well, we did our work and we're going home by 7 p.m. every day. You know, like we started at 10 and went home by like 6 or 7, which was like kind of... you know, it was like, oh, this is actually, you know, this is humane. Right. you know, either like we're like there at 8 a.m. and leave at 2 a.m. and then we go have drinks, you know, and try to figure out how to do it. But there was just an efficiency. And I think because everyone just so happy to be back at work. It was really,
that's
really
awesome.
Great.
Well, we've got a lot to cover here. We want to talk about a lot of different things. We should probably give them a little clue into some embarrassing details of Michael's career, about how comprehensive it's been. He left Juilliard in 2003 to work on the Broadway revival of Big River. He was in the original production of Bear, which was my first introduction to Michael Arden. I had that, album on repeat on my iTunes back in the day. He's worked, he obviously was Quasimodo in the Hunchback of Notre Dame at San Diego,
which I saw at Paper Mill, which was mind-blowing.
That cast album is also incredible. He's worked on
Absolute Fire,
lots of television shows, a couple episodes of Mrs. Maisel, Nurse Jackie, The Good Wife, Grey's Anatomy, Numbers, The Mentalist, 100 episodes of Anger Management, which I feel like we could do a whole hour on working with Charlie Sheen. And he also is...
I blacked out. I don't remember it at all. I was out.
And he's also a very decorated director, as we've discussed. He was nominated for a Tony for the Once on This Island Broadway revival, the Spring Awakening Deaf West Broadway revival. He was nominated for a Tony for that as well. He directed Annie at the Hollywood Bowl, and he's working on lots of upcoming projects, including this feature film, The Book of Ruth, starring Ruth Wilson and Matt Bomer. Wow, I'm exhausted. How do you do it?
Well, and I wanted to just jump in for a second because Dan got to mention his introduction. I remember... in college, or actually I was in high school, Benj Pasek singing I'm Not Afraid from Easter Rising on YouTube. I remember that being like an early YouTube obsession for me.
I am not afraid to hold you. Now you're sleeping by my side. I am not afraid.
Being like, oh, Michael Arden's a writer. No, wait, Michael Arden's not a writer. Michael Arden's a, why is he in Big River? Why is he, wait a minute. I could not, I remember hearing that song and being like, this is beautiful and loving that song. And then like, what, it's just your career has, it's impossible to follow. What are you doing? Where are,
I think it's ADHD, honestly.
But I can fully relate to it. I've Same. Never wanted to do just one thing. It just doesn't make sense. I can't just do the one thing. So have you always been like that? Did you always have a plan to do all of these things or?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, even as a kid, when I was like a little kid, I would like build sets for plays, but then like kind of like explain to my grandparents who raised me, like what the play was about, but I wouldn't like act in it. I would just like explain like, oh, here's the chair that the character sits in. But, you know, so like looking back, I'm like, oh yeah, I guess I was like, you know, creating stories for people in a sort of like curatorial way. I don't know. But, and then I loved performing and loved singing in church choir and went to Interlochen Arts Academy, like as a performer, and ended up getting into Juilliard. But I was also like, for a while I was trying to be a lighting designer. So I was like, maybe going to go to school for lighting design. But then I got into Juilliard. I was like, I have to go to Juilliard. I can't like say no to that to be a lighting designer. Are you crazy? I don't know. I guess I just, I want to learn and know and contribute to as many facets of the, of storytelling as possible, especially theatrical storytelling. And it's just all sides fascinate me. And I think I hope they feed into each other. And that's the main piece of advice I have for like young artists who come and they're like, how do I, you know, be a director or how do I be an actor? And I was like, well, look at all the other people in the room and learn what they do because that will help you do your work better, not only as a communicator, but as a facilitator as well. So I don't know. And I just get really bored and antsy really quickly. Like I can't watch TV shows because I can't, the thought of like having to come back and watch another episode of something the next day of the same show, really, like, I can't do it.
Totally.
So you have to watch the whole thing, or you just don't watch it all?
No, I just usually like watch maybe the pilot and then I'm like, ah, I'm good.
Wow.
I don't know. It's a weird thing. I watched Game of Thrones, but only like, I think because my husband like chained me down to watch it, but I can't. Yeah. I've got to watch weird. Like if I watch TV, it's got to be like the news or like House Hunters or something, where it's like a different story each week, or like an anthology series, you know, like Black Mirror. I'm like, oh, it's like on theme or something. But totally. I guess it's so funny. I've been like Googling like ADHD because I think I might like have a problem with it, but. Too much information for this podcast.
No, I couldn't relate to anything more. And I get bored so quickly. And so I think, you know, that's why I think we're so enamored with your careers, because we, Dan and I both just want to do as many things as possible. And so, you know, that I think the jumping around, we're like, oh yes, it is possible. It is, you know, you can do it. But do you feel like when you are in this mode, when you're like, oh, I'm directing something now, or I'm acting in something now, do you just throw yourself 110% into that? That's a moment in time, and then on to the next thing. And it's like 110% into these moments. Does that feel?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. I've like become like obsessed for a while, like compulsive about a project where I don't think about anything else. Like if I'm in tech for something, like you don't want to know me, you know what I mean? Or if I'm like working on a project, cause it's all I care about. Which is great, but then can leave you a little like grieved when they're done, you know? So that's the inverse of that. I think that's its shadow. It's ugly shadow. It's the like, you know, feeling like it's like after I direct a show, I like really, I don't want to go watch it again. Because I won't be able to make changes. It's really hard for me to like go back to, and not because like I don't love what the company's doing or whatever, but like with like Once on This Island, like I couldn't see it after it opened. I still wanted to like do a bunch of, I still wanted to change a lot of things, but I was like, I can only see it once a month.
Right.
Because I just like, otherwise I'll just be like, well, let's just go back in rehearsal. I mean, what else are we doing? You know, right. Which like the frustrated company, like, it's like, oh my God, we want to kill you. But you know, it's because then it becomes exciting to me, and I can have taken a step away from something and then approach it like as something that already exists and not something in process.
Right? Totally. Totally. Cause I wondered about that, because as someone who, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, as someone who does want to do so many different things, like directors generally don't come and see the show a lot after it opens, if it's a long running hit, but like you have to keep it up. You have to see it to make sure that it's, you know, that opening night is still, you know, intact. But, you know, I guess that would be hard if you're like, no, I'm done. You're not ever done with it. I don't know. I don't want to like offend the cast that's out there, you know, but it's like, you know, you're like, no, I'm done with that now.
I mean, some people, you know, some directors like are there every day. Right. And, you know, I've heard stories from actor friends of mine who are like, oh my God, like we, after we open, the director's there every day. And it just would drive me crazy. I want the company to like, be able to soar on their own. And, you know, and I also like, I'm fortunate enough to work with such incredible, you know, talented stage managers and associates who can make sure that like the integrity of what we were all trying to make together is maintained. But I can't. It's also why I won't get a tattoo. It's because I know the minute I get it, I'll be like, oh, I hate it. I got to change it.
Yeah.
I love it. I know. Really to thy own self be true, you know?
So how did this project come about this summer, the Forest of Arden Co? What originated that idea? And can you talk a little bit about that project?
Yeah.
It seemed really interesting.
Well, I had started doing years ago in Los Angeles in like 2012, I think was our first piece, creating a company called the Forest of Arden that did site-specific immersive narrative theater and dance theater. And I was just really interested in how blurring the line between audience and performer and giving the audience more to do within a theatrical setting. And so when the pandemic occurred, I was like, I had always been like walking around this area in upstate New York and driving around thinking, God, these places are so beautiful. It'd be so great to like see dance in this abandoned building, or, you know, the list goes on. And I thought, I saw so many people, of course, hurting economically and, you know, financially, but also really feeling like, especially there at the beginning of the pandemic, when like we didn't know what was going to happen, it was like feeling really artistically stifled. And so I started calling all my like favorite people, or people who I like wanted to work with for a while, dancers who I obsessed with but had never been able to hire.
Yeah.
Because I like there wasn't a track for their particular talent. So I like mm-hmm. called a bunch of people that either I had worked with before or I had been fans of. And I said, hey, do you want to like make a piece of crazy, immersive outdoor theater while experimenting with ways technology could keep audiences distanced and safe, and how we might, how you can, we could work as a sort of democratic company in a very non-democratic field at times. So we raised money on Kickstarter, which is like my favorite pastime to do this. And we all quarantined together and tested, quarantined together. We started meeting on Zoom a couple months prior. And then we really like developed the show, devised the show in person. Like we didn't have anything when we started. And we had filmmakers and composers and stage managers and dancers and actors and singers and choreographers. And we made this like three city project that happened over the course of one weekend, where we like had guinea pig audiences that were instructed via their phones where to go and could hear a sort of like soundscape and videoscape directly in their headphones that then like linked up perfectly with what they were seeing. So they could see like a lip sync from like 200 feet away, that, you know, things like that. So we explored with FM technology and as well as that technology I was talking about. And it was wild. It's like the greatest time I've ever had. I can't, it was like summer camp, yet we've really made something cool and developed like a way of working together as a company that felt really democratic, in which like every single person mattered equally. No decision was made without the entire company's voting on it. Like even like we had to cancel a show because like we lost a location, and then we had to like uninvite people who were going to see it. And as opposed to, you know, usually like one person does that and then informs the company what, but no, we sat as a group and like decided together what we were going to do, what we wanted the play to be about, what we wanted to see it, how we wanted to use our funds, that kind of stuff. And it was like so liberating. It was very, very Russian of us.
I was going to say it was very, very Mary Overly, yeah. Very Tina yeah. Landau and Anne Bogart of you to have that kind of horizontal
yeah.
system as opposed to like this kind of top-down vertical system that we
well,
have.
Well, just, I mean, the best ideas come that way. I mean, I always feel...
Right.
You always find when you like... You know, and it's a good reminder to me. It's like, it can be very alluring to like hear like the word director and be like, oh, I'm in charge. But no, not really. You're just like there to like keep the walls up.
You said facilitator earlier. I really liked that perspective.
Traffic cop. I also go by traffic cop. That's
awesome.
I help people like stay in, make sure they can find their light. That's really yeah, all I
not
do.
Not get hit by things.
Right.
Yeah, that's safety cap.
We would love to keep going and keep pushing through, and we would love to do a deep dive into one of your projects. I could help you choose, but you can choose whatever you want to talk about. It can be directing or acting.
Oh,
whatever.
I think you should choose.
Well, I what do you? Well, Dan, let's. I kind of want to do all of them.
You know,
let's
what
do
I'm
all
say.
Of them and just start at the beginning. No, I know what Dan's going to choose, but I wonder because. The hunchback process as an actor, maybe we could do one as an actor and one as a director. That
great.
The hunchback process, seeing it at Paper Mill, I loved it. I thought it was so dark. And I mean, was it Man of Stone, the big act two one?
Made of Stone.
Like, chill. I just, I'd love to talk about that one because was that one of the last musicals you did as an actor?
I think it might have been. Yeah, because I had directed Spring Awakening in LA and then did the out of town at La Jolla of Hunchback, like back to back. Like I had to miss the first few days of rehearsal to open Spring Awakening. Wow. And then so I was sort of doing those shows simultaneously, as well as shooting Anger Management. And that, so I was like, my friend and the understudy on that job, Julian, had to do like a show a week. So I could like, I was very Elaine Stritch. I would like,
yes,
I would see the show. I would see like the Sunday night of, I would like see the Sunday night show of Spring Awakening and take notes, and then shoot like Anger Management Monday and Tuesday, and then drive down to La Jolla and do this Hunchback, and then drive back up after the Sunday matinee to see the evening show of Spring Awakening, and then do the shooting. It was crazy. But yeah, I think that was the last musical I did.
Was that a dream during that time, or was that like the dream, or was that like, I mean, I bet you didn't sleep for about.
No, I was exhausted. I mean, like it was a time in my life, and then going to Paper Mill and doing it, like the Hunchback was such a demanding physical and emotional vocal. Yeah. It probably wasn't the smartest thing to do, but it was like, I've never felt more alive. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Me on the 5 freeway, like chugging coffee, like trying to keep, you know, while on the phone, like trying to figure out how we could like move Spring Awakening forward.
Trying to spin the plates, yeah. Just plate spinning. Yeah. It's unbelievable.
But it was really, I mean, I was in the room with like I love Scott Schwartz and I love Steven Schwartz and Alan Menken and Chase Brock and people who I've known for a long time and was getting to work with, and Michael Kozarin, and it's just like incredible, you know, titans of this industry. So it was like, it was so nice to like, to just show up and just like be an actor. And I really, you know, I really just took I wanted to like kind of disappear into that role.
Yeah.
I think because I had so much other stuff in my head at the time, I just like really was like, a lot of actors tend to want to like question a lot of things and like, well, what if I did this, or what if I said this, or you know, and I was like, I'm not gonna like say a word that isn't a line that's written for me in this process. And I had a great time, you know.
That's really interesting, because I'm sure there would be a pressure. I always assume that there would be a pressure on somebody like you who has such a understanding of all of stagecraft, that when you become the lead actor in a company, that you're then going to contribute kind of all of your brain. So it would be interesting to step back from
that. Yeah, I mean, Spring Awakening has just opened in LA, but like no one like knew I was a director at that point. Like besides me. In fact, Steven Schwartz gave me a mug that said, "What I really want to do is direct," as like a gag gift for birthday rehearsal. Because he was like, "I know you really want to direct." But also, you know, I have my point of view, and Scott had his point of view, and it was so nice to live in someone else's. You know, it's like it's like when I have acted since like working on King Lear with Sam Gold, like, I mean, what I just want to like show up and do my job as an actor. And I think like that it isn't my place to try to like put my spin on something. My job is to like listen and respond as a character. That's it.
That's a really awesome point of view.
Truly.
Because giving over the permission to not have control is probably the hardest thing to do when you're only in a position where you don't have control. But like surrendering that idea when you are used to sometimes having control and then sometimes not, and kind of understanding that balance, is something I hadn't really thought about.
It's really freeing to be able to do that. I mean, you know, like,
yeah.
I wouldn't say that I like love it being an actor.
Right.
But it is really like, oh, I can, you know, in the times that I've been acting, it's like, oh, I don't have to stay for the production meeting. This is amazing. I can't believe I'm done, and I get to bow and people clap for me, you know. It's cool. And you know, actors, I have such incredible respect for actors, probably because I do it sometimes, but just the hardest thing to do as an actor is to like not see yourself from the front.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like you actually have to kind of be like ignorant to so much You have to know so much, but then when you step on stage, you have to be ignorant to everything that you don't know, which is so much more than you do as a character. So it's, you know, it's like a, it's a real adjustment. And so, and, nice to get to be able to be reminded of that, because like, it's not easy to do that. It's also scary. Like I have stage fright, you know, sometimes. So like,
of course,
you know, it's like, oh yeah, actors are like doing a lot. It's cool.
How do you feel like one contributes to the other? Do you feel, because are there like the, all of the different hats that you wear, is there a way that acting feeds directing, feeds writing, feeds, and then kind of,
I mean, I, you know, they all, it, as an actor, being a director, I think is helpful in like knowing when to shut up, you know, or just like being like, oh, actually, like I don't have to worry so much. Mm. You know, I, like it's so easy when you're on stage and like everyone's looking at me that you need to like somehow provide the play to the audience. I'm like, you really don't have to do that at all. All you have to do is like say your lines and mean them and stand in your light, you know, but it also, but then again, it like helps me as I, that I sort of like, you know, have a sense for staging. So like, you know, yeah. You know, you see it, some of the best actors have like no sense of like where to, how to physically relate to some, to someone on stage, you know what I mean? So, and I sort of get the like balance and of stage picture and stuff, which I guess kind of might be helpful or annoying for a director who like isn't into that. So, you know, but I think just understanding that, that, you're not like alone is really helpful. You're not like you, the responsibility doesn't all have to fall on you as the actor to like give the play to an audience. Cut to, I mean, Jefferson Mays, you know, whatever. he does it. But, and then as a director, like just knowing how to communicate to actors, because I've certainly as an actor been communicated to by a director in incredibly unhelpful ways. Or disrespectful ways. So,
right.
That's really helpful in terms of, you know, you don't want to say like, can you like, you just got to make me cry here. Like, you know what I mean? Like that has been said to me as an actor. And I'm like, that's super unhelpful. So it helps that, that sort of, you know, articulation is helpful.
I was so profoundly moved by your contributions to my favorite childhood, my most influential musical in my young adult life was Spring Awakening, and to see your spin on that story, aside from the fact that there was a whole new take on it because of the capabilities of the actors, or lack thereof, depending on how you would want to frame that, what was your approach to that process to kind of take a different look at it from the way it was done originally?
Well, I, like you, was like an enormous fan of the show. I saw the first preview at the Atlantic.
Wow.
I was a huge fan of Duncan way before, like his Phantom Moon album was like literally in college, played it out. So when I heard Spring Awakening was happening, I was like already, I was like the built-in audience for that show. And then I was doing a show on Broadway at the time that transferred to the original production was on Broadway. And I think I might've seen Spring Awakening like 12 times, like, and then I saw the tour and ended up marrying someone from the tour. I mean, it's like, it's like followed me around, you know? But I remember hanging out with Andy Mantis, my now husband. What a weird term, now husband. I don't know why I said it like that. when he was doing Spring Awakening at the Amundsen and I was doing Def West Pippin at the Taper, and we were like sharing rehearsal space and doing right there. And we started talking then. We were friends for a long time before we were a couple, and talking about how it would be really interesting to look at Spring Awakening through that lens of communication, when actually, and taking a look at like what was happening in deaf culture at the time in Europe, and looking, giving like these kind of hormone enraged kids more than that, like a bigger problem to deal with, You know, like it's like not just in angsty kids. It like gives it context. It gives them like the deafness. And I think what we uncovered with our work on Spring Awakening gave them like a reason to a reason to sing. And also I just like having worked with on two shows prior with the deaf community and with Deaf West, I really wanted to one uplift these performers who might not have a chance to be by like making them rock stars in a way that they like really like don't get the opportunities they should. Like even if like a deaf character is deaf in a play, it's like always like, you know, they're never like moving lights focused on them and like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, it was a real opportunity to like really make these performers rock stars. And tell a story about deafness. And the work I had done prior was sort of using deaf performers and hearing performers together in a world in which like deafness may or may not have existed. And I like really wanted to like dig into the stories and horrible, you know, history of deaf culture and what was happening in education at the time. So it kind of like, when I started on the process, it like, I certainly didn't know like, oh, this is going to be about the Milan conference when deaf students refused forced oralism and, you know, and it just sort of like with enough Googling and talking to people and, you know, whiskey, and it sort of evolved into what it became.
I think that's really interesting. Because that's what I hadn't really put to words is exactly what you're saying. You basically found a way to dramatize angst so that the angst had something to be anchored to, as opposed to just being a feeling of general frustration, yeah. Which you kind of noticed in the first one. It was like tied to this like inability to communicate, which is super genius.
I think like if you're looking objectively at the story, like it's very easy, you know, to be like, oh, these are just a bunch of like horny kids, like get over it or wait a couple of years, as opposed to like giving it like a real worldly conflict that was you know, giving them something to bash their heads about. I think helped with audiences who weren't necessarily angsty teenagers. Who like, if you're an angsty teenager going to see Spring Awakening, you're like, yeah, I totally get it.
Yeah,
right. Everybody, you know. And then, but if you're like 45, you're like, yeah, no, I get it. But like, I paid $150 for this seat.
Right.
What is it about? You know. Which I think is, you know, what's so great about how that show is constructed is that it can like withstand new lenses, and that's a testament to, you know, Michael Mayer and Duncan and Steven.
I must know why they went into the green pastures. I will never forget that moment where they walk up stage at the end. Where's that conception come from?
It just was like an image I had in my mind of like, I knew that like the kids at the end, like had to leave and that the adults could not, it was like too late for them. I knew that they had to like this, and in the design, like we always wanted to feel like a very kind of like constructed, almost claustrophobic space. So that then they could leave onto like hope for the future and greater understanding. So that was sort of where that came from. And it was just an image I had in my mind of like the these adults being left alone.
Mm-hmm.
Because their lives had passed them by. It was too late for them. Very sad.
Very sad, but very sad. but optimistic. I mean, it is.
It's about the future. So it always. I mean, it was different in each production. In our first LA production, we like. Yeah, it was very different in each one how they exited, but always with the same kind of intent that like. Something magical like occurred and they were able to finally get out of this space that had no like exits before.
Amazing.
And they had something to do with, you know, growing up.
Yeah. Well, that free will. Yeah. Well, that was one of those things that that I just for to be honest, the song of Purple Summer, like when I was 16 and angsty, and I saw it for the first time, and I saw them pull the microphones out of the jackets, and their inner thought as a rock song. I was like, whoa, I totally get it, and you know, yeah, fuck everybody. But the end, I didn't get the ending. When I was in that space.
I think the end. I mean, the song of Purple Summer. God, I can't say it, but like you know, it's beautiful. It's beautiful poetry, but I think it's a bit obtuse. It's a bit hard to be like, okay, what does this actually mean? And I really treated it like an epilogue, like
right.
The play was over. This is our like benediction to the audience.
Right.
That's why like in my production, I had them like take off their costumes again. And so we're all like, we're sort of now able to like speak to the audience and as 25-year-olds playing children, you know, it became a bit of a different thing, but I wanted to give it a bit of give some story and leave us with that final image of like, remember that moment? Remember when like we could just go out into the world sort of knowing nothing and we'd be able to stumble and find it on our own. And our parents like had to let go. Sort of that's what I wanted to achieve there. It's like the hope of like moving towards some sort of greater understanding and how we treat each other better and treat ourselves better.
And I think what was so moving about it was that I can't remember in this moment what I took away from it, but it was one of those things that happens where it leaves you with just as many questions as it does answers. So it gives you this reason to communicate with somebody after the show, kind of what was that? What did you think that was? Which I think is
which is why we wanted you to have you on the podcast
so I could get an answer years later.
Yeah, it's they're all going to going to Disneyland. Honestly, it's they're about to take the Thunder
I thought it was something
Railroad.
Like they're all in purgatory, and then you know one of those.
Yeah, I mean it's like this sort of gray space represented like being trapped in a world in which like your freedoms, your educational system, your spiritual beliefs, your sexual prowess is all determined by a construct created and passed down through parents who had it created and passed down to them. So you are in a way imprisoned by this. And that was this, you know, I wanted to represent enlightenment and being able to like move past that. So at some point we stop this reciprocal and circular like nightmare of shame.
Absolutely.
That's it. I guess.
Isn't
I don't know. That's one way to think about it. I mean, Disneyland is also
I love it. So we'll thank you. First of all, we're coming to the end. Thank you for spending your morning with us. This is, we, again, if you haven't gotten that we're fans and of yours, yet,
now,
but we have a couple questions that we end with. You mentioned it earlier, but is there any other advice that you've had for someone starting out?
Just learn as much as you can. I mean, you know, ask people if you can watch what they do, if you can sit in the back row. I wouldn't be where I am if I had not shadowed producers, assisted directors, interned with lighting designers, spent an hour in a costume shop learning about how a costumer works. You know, I think it's like, it's very easy to become like laser specific, which is what we're always taught, like focus, focus, focus. But actually, you know, you need to know, you know, a laser only looks focused because of the space around it. So I think you have to like become as well rounded of an artist in your field as you can. And also even outside of art, like
totally
go like, you know, have an affair. I don't know. Learn something.
Crash and burn the personal life is a great way to find some artistic depth.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For sure.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah. And my other advice is to just it's going to suck more than it's going to be good. So like enjoy that and know that that is part of learning. Which is what I'm trying to remind myself.
Yeah.
Today.
I needed to hear that.
Yeah, for sure.
Because most days suck, you know, and then the good ones are really good, but.
Yeah. And mistakes and And falling down is like really helpful. As Lynn Ahrens wrote, the failures and the foolishness lead us to the truth. It's like, yeah, you learn so much more out of a flop or a failure than you do out of a success.
Totally.
Find a way to like find grace in that. Yeah. That's my advice.
Yeah, totally.
But I'm still trying.
I heard somebody saying recently, you got to run towards what's hard. It's the same kind of thing.
Yeah, I like that.
It's great.
Yeah. And then our last question that we ask is, and this is why I'm really interested to hear what you have on this, but we call it our unreachable star question. What it's just like, what is way in the horizon, something you're pointed to, something that you're headed towards that you'd like to achieve now with everything that you've done? I mean, it's just, you know, you can't say that, oh, I want to be a director. Oh, I want to.
I want to create a like national theater for the US that is like a company in the sort of like Danse Theater Wuppertal, you know, style, is constantly creating new work. You know, it's like, it's what I wish Lincoln Center could and would be, if, you know, a true rep company that focuses on inclusive work and that brings accessible work to the entire country that isn't cost prohibitive. Mm. You know, that's it.
Absolutely. I feel like the Kennedy Center could do something like that too, right? Isn't that kind of like what
you would think and hope, you know? We can only hope for the future.
Yeah.
That people understand that, and that our lawmakers and, you know, and ultimately population who votes them into power understand that there is no nation without culture.
Couldn't agree more.
Well, I hope that that's happens. Wonderful. That's
me too.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. So that's what I want to do.
Sounds great.
I could not.
I will start the Kickstarter as soon as we sign off.
Let's just back to Kickstarter. Why not? If there's gridlock in Congress, we'll just go back to Kickstarter.
Keep putting Broadway stars in movies, and maybe it'll happen. How can people find you? And what can we look forward to?
you can see what our company is up to on theforestofarden.com. And we have something really exciting that's coming with our company that should be announced hopefully soon. So stay tuned for that.
Yes.
I don't really do much social media besides Instagram. So you can follow me at Michael Arden or follow Forest of Arden Co. And begin to go down the rabbit hole of that incredible group of 40 or so artists that have assembled trying to look for that unreachable star together.
Oh, I love it.
Awesome.
Oh, amazing. Michael, thank you so, so much. Wow, we got some t-shirts to make. We got some t-shirts and some posters to make.
I got some journaling to do, as I think where I'm at. Jeez.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you for listening to Guys Who Like Musicals. We are now part of the Broadway Podcast Network.
Woo!
We are hosted by Dan Tracy.
That's you.
And Joe Carroll.
That's me.
We're produced by Ryan Kincaid, and Matthew Mucha is the social content manager.
You can find us on Instagram at Guys Who Like Musicals, on Twitter at Musical Guys, or the old-fashioned way at www.guyswholikemusicals.com.
If you'd like a chance to be featured on the Ask the Guys segment of our show, please call 203-900-7990 and leave a message with your question. As always, thanks for listening.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.